think it's very clear that this is a network that we are investigating, and as I've said, it continues at a pace. There's extensive investigations going on and activity taking place across Greater Manchester as we speak. So thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen.
That's it. Thank you. Chief Constable Ian Hopkins of the Greater Manchester Police describing the growing investigation into Monday's Ariana Grande concert bombing that killed 22 people. ISIS has claimed responsibility. Authorities now have at least 5 people in custody, and they are looking for more. That great activity, Hopkins mentioned, includes lots of extra police and some military troops on the streets. Authorities set off a controlled explosion today at an apartment in Manchester's city center. We're going to talk at length about ISIS's communication strategy, including the group's mastery of social media, in just a minute. But we're going to begin with the latest from Manchester with Griff Whitty. He's the London bureau chief for The Washington Post. Welcome.
Good to be here.
Well, it appears that network is the operative word today. We just heard the chief constable say this is likely a network that they are investigating. What do we know about that?
Well, we know that this was not an attack in which there was a single individual who carried it out, who planned it, who built the bomb, and who executed it. It seems that increasingly clear that this was a broader effort, that there were multiple people involved. The person who carried out the bombing was a 22-year-old local individual who, just as far as police are concerned, did not fit the profile of someone who was a mastermind of this attack, who would have had the capability of building this bomb. And so police are looking for the person who did build the bomb, and it's not clear at this point that they have that person in custody. They've arrested 4 additional people today. They arrested one person, the bomber's older brother, yesterday. So they now have 5 people connected to this case in custody. There were also 2 arrests in Libya today. The bomber's younger brother and the bomber's father were both arrested there, and the counterterrorism service there says that the younger brother was preparing an attack and that they interrupted that.
So both brothers are in custody, the older and the younger?
That's correct, yes.
And the father, who had initially told the New York Times that he didn't believe his son had committed this bombing in Manchester.
That's right. The father has come out and said that the brothers are innocent, and that the son who is deceased, that he was not the person responsible. Police, however, feel very confident that he was.
So he had traveled to Libya, right, to visit his parents recently.
That's right. So he had been there quite recently. Relatives and friends say that he had been there. He's been traveling back and forth quite a bit over the past 5 or 6 years. He was a university dropout. Someone who didn't seem to have a great deal of direction in his life. A lot of people in the neighborhood say that he seemed a little he was drifting, but that he had become radicalized relatively recently, and that there were reports that he was out in the street saying prayers and chanting, and that he perhaps had fallen under the sway of radical groups.
What is the scene there in Manchester? I know that there are lots of Libyans who are living there now, and they immigrated there in two major waves in the 80s when they fled the Gaddafi regime, and again in 2011 after Gaddafi's overthrow. So what is the scene there in terms of the Libyan community and radicalization?
So the mosque where the family had worshipped, they came out, the trustee of the mosque came out with a statement today saying, first of all, condemning the attack in very strong terms, saying that this was an act of cowardice, but also saying that there had been some reports in the British media that the attacker had worked at the mosque at one point, and the trustee of the mosque categorically denied that. He said that's not true. And the trustee of the mosque also said that there have been some anti-Muslim attacks, or both verbal and also attacks on mosque property in recent days, or just in the last couple of days since the bombing on Monday night. Overall, I think that the mood in Manchester is one of people wanting to move beyond this attack and wanting to not allow this bomber to create friction within the community and to divide the community. Manchester is an incredibly multicultural place. It's a place where people take great pride in the fact that there are immigrants from all over here. And there have been really strong appeals from all sectors of the community, from all faiths, to not let this bombing divide the community.
Griff Witte, London Bureau Chief for The Washington Post. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Madeline.
Joining us now, Rukmini Kalamaki, foreign correspondent covering ISIS and al-Qaeda for The New York Times. She's written extensively about ISIS's social media and communications efforts. Welcome to you. So first, what more can you tell us about the arrest today of the younger brother and the father in Libya?
So he was arrested by the Special Deterrence Force in Tripoli. And in a Facebook statement that was reported by my colleague Declan Walsh, they're saying that they had been collecting intelligence on Hashem Abedi during the 6 weeks previously, and that they had indications that he was planning an attack in the Libyan capital. They didn't provide any further details, but that suggests that his family was also involved in terror.
And anything about the father?
Not much. I mean, I think he's just been taken into custody. All we know is that he was detained.
Right. So you have been parsing social media messages by ISIS surrounding this attack. And what are you seeing? And what is your analysis?
So the first claim of responsibility from ISIS came at 7:50 a.m. Yesterday, which was about 14 and a half hours after the attack. It was on a platform called Nashir, which is an official ISIS chat room and messaging service. What's unusual about that is that ISIS typically claims credit first on Amok, which is a different platform, and they claimed it here on Nashir. That has happened before in the case of the Brussels attack. But they seem to have reversed the order. The statement said that the attack was in revenge for aggressions against the homes of Muslims. I'm taking that to mean that they're referring to airstrikes in Mosul and other areas, which in recent months have indeed killed a lot of civilians. And secondly, it said that that the attacker, who they called a soldier of the caliphate, had placed explosive devices, plural, amidst the concert goers. So when that first came out, that was puzzling to us, because at that point the police were talking about a suicide bomber. But in subsequent days, we have now learned that he actually placed a backpack bomb at the scene, which is starting to make the Nashir statement more credible.
And so they claim responsibility, ISIS, for attacks like this one and previous attacks. How do authorities know that they, in fact, were behind the attacks, or if they're just bragging?
Well, for one thing, you can look at the data for past attacks and look at the behavior of ISIS. And despite popular perception, I think people assume that ISIS claims everything. In fact, ISIS has been remarkably disciplined in only claiming attacks that they have either directed, that they have enabled in some way, or that they have inspired. And that's the important thing to understand. They consider inspired attacks like Orlando, San Bernardino, to be very much their handiwork. So it would be out of character for ISIS to claim something that they're not at some level involved in. The second issue is of course the sophistication of this attack. The explosive was powerful. It killed more than 20 people. Compare that to the Stade de France bombers in the Paris attacks in November of 2015. There were three of them. Mm-hmm. They blew themselves up outside the soccer stadium in Paris, and they killed themselves and one other person. So you can see the difference. And those, we know, were trained ISIS operatives who had come directly from Syria, who had received coaching in Syria from core elements of the Islamic State, and yet they basically failed in detonating those explosives and causing harm.
Right. And so in this case, we don't know whether or not Salman Abedi was trained yet. We don't know that.
We don't know that, but what officials are saying is that he's part of a network. That's you know, mm-hmm. counterterrorism speak for saying that he was embedded within the terrorist group. And certainly travel to Libya and Syria, those are two locations that are intimately linked with the Islamic State, begins to look suspicious within that lens.
So how does this differ from these so-called lone wolf attacks that we keep hearing about?
So Lone wolf attacks are attacks by actors who are acting alone, as the term suggests,
yeah.
and who are responding to the voluminous propaganda that ISIS is putting out online. The counterterrorism officials will tell you that, in fact, there are no real lone wolves. They'll point out that the only true lone wolf in perhaps the history of American terrorism is the Unabomber. That was the one and only person that they found had absolutely no connections to anybody else, and truly came up with this, terrible plan on his own. What we found in our own reporting is that a lot of the young men that are initially described by officials as being lone wolves, with time, you end up finding at least a digital connection to ISIS. Not all of them. There's been certainly exceptions. The Orlando attacker in San Bernardino seem to be such examples. But for example, there in 2015, months before the horrific Paris attacks, a young man named Sid Ahmed Klam plotted to open fire on a church in France. When he went to attack the church, he actually shot himself in the leg instead. And then, to compound things, he called 911 because he was bleeding out. And when emergency responders showed up to pick him up, he couldn't get his story straight on why, where he had found the gun, how he had shot himself in the leg. Anyway, so they put him away, and they very quickly concluded that this was just an amateur. Well, with time, the records of what was found on his laptop and in his car were eventually divulged. And in those chats on his computer, you see that he was talking directly to senior ISIS operatives who had, in fact, arranged for him to get the weapons. I have that chat, and I've reported on it in previous stories. It's truly chilling. It's basically ISIS in Syria sending this young man blow-by-blow directions, go to this particular sandwich shop in this particular suburb of Paris, cross the street. Across the street, you're going to see a large complex. Enter the complex. In the complex, you're going to find a parking lot. In the parking lot, look for a Renault Megane, either the most recent model or the one just before it. When you find the Renault Megane, look on the top left tire. You're going to find the key. Open the back seat. And in the back seat, you're going to find the duffel bag, and in the duffel bag, you're going to find your weapons. And that's exactly what happened. So it showed that even somebody that was as much of a failure as that young man who manages instead to shoot himself in the leg was being coached really at the most minute level by the terror group.
Do you expect to find a similar kind of coaching in this instance?
You know, it's too early to say, but yeah. There are enough clues. The ferocity of the blast, the deadliness of it, the fact that he didn't trip off any tripwires as he was plotting for this attack, and the fact that he, as officials are saying, was part of a network, is starting to suggest that this is something that was put together and not something that was was carried out by a lone actor.
Now, I understand the FBI has been targeting this British-born group that they're calling the Legion. These are people who were born in Britain but have become ISIS recruiters, and they killed one of the leaders recently, another one as well, Rafael Hosty, who could have been in contact with this man, Salman Abedi. And I wonder if you could tell us more about this particular group. I think it's about a dozen or so men are involved in it that the FBI is targeting, and what their methods are.
So this group of people, many of them have been killed by now, including Rafael Hosty. But they were basically online cheerleaders for the Islamic State early on, and as a result, I think people discounted them. You know, they were loudly on Twitter cheering after every single terror attack, openly recruiting for the group. And in fact, one of the members of this group, a guy called Junaid Hussein, was the person that the attackers in Garland, Texas, contacted. Literally in the hours before their attack, you can see in the attacker's public Twitter timeline that he basically tagged Junaid Hussein, and as if saying, watch what I'm about to do. And then he goes out, carries out this attack that thankfully didn't kill anybody except himself and his accomplice. And immediately after news of that incident hit, you see Junaid Hussein's timeline, just light up with Allah Akbar, Allah Akbar, praising it and basically acting as as the propaganda for that attack. They have been targeting this group since at least 2015, if not earlier, and with some success. Junaid Hussein has been killed, Rafael Husti has been killed. A man that may have been associated with them called Abu Issa al-Amriki, who was very involved in trying to recruit people in the U.S. as well as elsewhere, has been killed. And so they have made progress in degrading that particular cell within ISIS.
Junaid Hussein was just 21 years old, and yet he was one of the leaders of this group, the Legion, and he had a lot of influence, it appears, across the world.
He did.
And these are largely British-born men who were part of this group?
Not all of them. They're, for instance, Abu Issa al-Amriki, who was a prolific recruiter and what we're calling a remote control, cyber planner for the group. As his name suggests, he appears to have had some American connection, but that's never been completely divulged. He also went by Abu Saad al-Sudani, suggesting he was Sudanese, but in either case, he was not British.
In general, though, are ISIS recruiters still using social media effectively?
They're using social media certainly in terms of the lowest level. So it seems that when people are radicalized, what they do is they're young people, so they go to Twitter, to Instagram, to Snapchat, to Tumblr, to Facebook, etc., and they start trolling these engines for contacts. From there, they're passed on to some sort of encrypted chat that can happen on Telegram, that can happen on an app called Signal, on Threema, on Wickr, on ChatSecure. We lose visibility, and that's when they become dangerous and are possibly plotting an attack.
Rukmini Kalamaki, foreign correspondent covering ISIS and al-Qaeda for The New York Times. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Coming up on the program, we are going to switch gears and look at the history behind a simple recipe for pancakes written on the back of an envelope by civil rights icon Rosa Parks. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Rosa Parks, of course, famous civil rights icon who refused to sit at the back of the bus and kicked off the Montgomery bus boycotts. She devoted her life to fighting for civil rights. But when she was at home, after fighting for civil rights all day long, she liked to cook. The Library of Congress has her personal documents, and among them is a recipe for feather light pancakes written by Rosa Parks on the back of an old envelope.
At first glance, this recipe may just seem like a charming footnote, but I think it's a lot more. It's a window into a time and a place and a person.
That's Dan Pashman. He's host of the Sporkful podcast, and in a recent episode, Dan digs into that pancake recipe and its meaning, and Dan's here now to tell us more about that. Hi, Dan.
Hey, Madeline.
All right. She had a lot of items at the Library of Congress. What caught your eye about this particular recipe?
Well, so many of the documents that they released were very emotional and moving and powerful, but they weren't necessarily surprising in that they dealt with the topics you would expect Rosa Parks to be writing about. The pancake recipe just seemed so human. Mm-hmm. Just picturing her at the stove making pancakes, it really made me realize how little I actually knew about Rosa Parks.
And they're called feather light pancakes.
That's right. They're called feather light pancakes. The recipe is written on the back of a banking envelope. And as we looked into it on the Sporkful, the more we looked into it and the more we analyzed every little detail of this recipe, the more stories it revealed to us. And the first thing you notice about the recipe when you look at it is that it has peanut butter in it. Peanut butter mixed into the pancake batter.
Peanut butter.
And on the surface, you're just like, whoa, I don't know. Have you ever had that?
No.
I never had that. It sounds delicious, though. I want to eat that is your first reaction. But as we dug into it, it turns out that that's actually very significant because Rosa Parks was born in Tuskegee, Alabama. She took her stand on the bus in Montgomery, Alabama. And Tuskegee, of course, home of Tuskegee Institute and George Washington Carver, who is more famous than any American for popularizing the peanut, and in particular, popularizing it among African-American farmers after slavery. He really was, part of his mission was to help poor black farmers develop a cash crop other than cotton so they could support themselves. And he thought the peanut was the key. And so, and peanuts, even before that, have a long history in African cooking and were brought over to the American South by the slave trade. And so to see peanut butter there in Rosa Parks pancakes really taps into the history of peanuts in African American culinary history.
That is so interesting. And you found that out when you started doing research into it? You didn't know any of that before?
Yeah, I mean, I saw the peanut butter and I said, well, that looks delicious. I want to eat that. We went to the Library of Congress and interviewed a woman named Adrienne Cannon, who's the curator of the Rosa Parks papers there. And she said, this is a quintessential African-American recipe. And I felt kind of foolish for not having made the connection to George Washington Carver and Tuskegee and all that sooner, but I was glad she pointed it out to me.
Okay, and what's the significance of the bank envelope, the fact that she wrote that recipe on the back of that envelope?
Well, there's a couple things you can learn about her life from that. First, we all imagined that after the Montgomery bus boycott, Rosa Parks was sort of hoist on the proverbial shoulders of the civil rights movement and spend the rest of her life as a hero. And that's half the story. But it turns out that actually she and her husband faced, they both lost their jobs and were subject to death threats and horrific treatment in Alabama after she took her stand, so much so that they had to move to Detroit. And that banking envelope is from a bank in Detroit where she ended up spending more than half her life. In fact, the bus where she took her stand is in Detroit, not in Alabama now. It's at the Henry Ford Museum. And the other thing we learned from that banking envelope is that she was very frugal because she and her husband struggled with money their entire lives, especially after she took her stand on that bus. They had a very hard time making ends meet, and she recycled papers. Some of the documents in the Library of Congress collection are written on the back of shopping bags. She's writing personal essays and memories of her time in the civil rights movement on the back of a shopping bag because she would recycle everything because she was so frugal.
Wow. Okay, so after you did all your research, you tried out the recipe with a food writer named Nicole Taylor, and I just want to play a clip from your podcast of You Two in the Kitchen.
Rosa Parks probably made these pancakes a million gazillion times. She probably did not look at this envelope. What do you think?
Certainly not after she'd done it a few times.
Exactly. So this flour here is, I wonder if Mrs. Parks used white lily, because in my flour container here, it's all white lily, which is a Southern brand that Southerners love.
Okay, so it sounds like she experimented a little, at least with the flour. What happened? How did they turn out, the pancakes?
They were fantastic. Nicole and I were both worried. On the griddle, they looked very dense, and we were afraid they would be heavy, despite the fact that they're named Feather Light. But they lived up to their name, in fact. Even with the peanut butter inside, they were very light and cakey. You could definitely taste the peanut butter, but not in an overpowering way, not in a way that it weighed the pancakes down. We enjoyed them thoroughly. I will say, Nicole took some liberties with the recipe, as you could hear in that clip. And it's interesting, some Sporkful listeners were upset. I don't know if you have a take on this, Madeline. They were upset that we didn't follow the recipe to a T, which I understand. It wasn't a perfect recreation, but...
But what did she specify what kind of flour in the recipe?
She didn't, but like, for instance, the recipe says milk. Nicole used buttermilk. But some people emailed in and said, well, a lot of Southern cooks just say milk when they mean buttermilk. She also used butter instead of shortening or oil, which is what was specified in the recipe. But, you know, I sort of felt like Nicole was playing the role of a modern day chef, and she's very, very familiar with Southern cooking history and tradition. She was kind of channeling Rosa Parks, but adapting the recipe for the modern day. And it was almost like as if Rosa Parks was cooking this recipe today, I think she probably would have cooked it a lot like the way Nicole did it.
Well, let me just get back to the buttermilk, because they're called Feather Light pancakes. You say they are light, and wouldn't the buttermilk be the reason why they're light?
That could be. It's impossible for us to know for sure whether Rosa Parks meant buttermilk when she wrote milk on the back of that envelope. But the buttermilk certainly adds a little bit of a tang that I think does. Anytime you have tang, I think it tends to lighten up the way that a food comes across to you, even if it's actually heavy in certain ways.
Hmm. Okay, and the peanut butter.
Peanut butter was a home run.
Yeah.
I mean, as Nicole put it, you know, she had three bites without syrup, which says a lot.
And what about putting chocolate chips in there?
That's a home run move right there, Madeline. I couldn't argue with that. You know, but they were definitely...
That would definitely be straying from the
recipe. Right, you would be straying. But I think, look, recipes are living things, and recipes change and evolve over time. And so I think that it's okay to experiment. I was very excited to see the weekend after this episode came out how many tweets and Facebook posts I got from Sporkful listeners who were cooking the pancakes. And I thought that was really moving in a way to see people all over the country connecting with Rosa Parks. There's something so visceral about cooking a recipe that someone else made, as if you're, you know, you do feel in a sense like you're sharing a meal with that person. And that made me feel, and I think it made Nicole feel, more connected to Rosa Parks as a person than we had ever felt before.
I'm going to try this weekend. I can't wait.
Well, I want to hear you report back to me.
Maybe I'll add some chocolate chips. I don't know.
All right. I won't tell Mrs. Parks.
Dan Pashman, he's host of the Sporkful podcast, and you can check out the episode. It's called Searching for Rosa Parks Pancakes. It's on iTunes, at sporkful.com, or wherever you get your podcasts. Dan, thank you.
Thank you, Madeline.
Coming up on the program, Southern California drug rehab centers like to paint a rosy picture of how they can help those suffering from addiction.
It's a place of comfort, a place that helps you detox, a place that cares.
This place changed my life.
But a recent investigation by the OC Register shows how some rehab centers are exploiting addicts to rake in massive profits while doing little to help them recover. That story is next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. The L.A. Basin has a new nickname, the Rehab Riviera. That's because it has more than 1,000 licensed rehab centers and thousands more unlicensed sober living homes. But some of those rehab centers are taking advantage of a loosely regulated industry to exploit addicts. Unscrupulous providers are thriving as the opioid epidemic, prison diversion programs, and Obamacare fuel an unprecedented demand for treatment. And the addicts become a means for clinics to bilk both insurers and taxpayers out of hundreds of millions of dollars while doing little to treat those desperate for help. All that is according to a four-part series in the OC Register. And joining us to talk about this is Terry Seforza, one of the lead reporters on the series. Welcome to you.
Thanks, Melon.
And great to have you. And Andre Mouchard, who edited this series. Hi.
Thanks for having us.
Well, Andre, let's begin with you. Talk more about the conditions that are fueling this boom in rehab centers, because you have, of course, the opioid problem, but also Obamacare. How does that fit in?
Well, you know, think of it almost like welfare to a certain extent. There are flaws in the system, not necessarily, this isn't a political polemic or anything, this is just, there are flaws in the Obamacare system that some people have exploited. And, you know, if you sign up for insurance in California, if you move into California, you can sign up and get insurance that day or the next day. And insurance right now requires addiction treatment to be covered. And so the folks who are running rehab centers are bringing people in from around the country, signing them up for insurance, essentially investing in these addicts.
And Terry, how do they get them? How do they get these addicts to come to California?
Oh my gosh. Well, they've got lots of different ways to do that, from, you know, very physical ways of, like, you know, people trolling at, you know, drug courts and stuff to, like, get people who have been ordered into treatment, to these call centers, which are, you know, just, if you type in, you know, treatment or rehab on the internet, you will get, you know, I've been followed for months now with all sorts of ads. But, you know, there are these call centers you call in. They say, you know, hey, we have, you know, we'll check your insurance, and then we will send you to this awesome place, you know, in California. You know, it's beautiful. It's on the ocean and a perfect place to recover. And people are being directed there from all, you know, here from all over the country.
And then in some cases, they actually pay their airfare.
They have been, known to pay their airfare and pay the insurance premium. I mean, some people are getting signed up for insurance and they don't even know it. They're calling them scholarships. We've got you a scholarship. And what they do is they're bringing somebody in from out of state, triggering the change of life provisions that, you know, that are allowed by Covered California. The treatment centers, sometimes these interventionists, junkie hunters, body brokers, there's a few different names for them, they will pay the the premiums themselves. And, you know, for the $100 a month that they're shelling out or $200 a month, they're getting back, you know, tens of thousands and sometimes, you know, way more than that, hundreds of thousands of dollars from the insurance companies.
So how much money are we talking about, Andre? How much money can these rehab centers make?
You know, it's kind of an elusive number for us. We looked overall, right now, addiction abuse is in the like $468 billion, I think was the number we used. Now, that's for addiction. That's for what they consider to be fraudulent coverage to a certain extent. How that is broken down, we don't know the exact numbers, but it's likely in the billions.
And we have to say that some of these are ethical treatment centers,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, and we want to be really clear. The story, just like a car crash story, is about the things that went wrong, okay?
Yeah.
We're not writing about the folks who do a good job, and there are plenty of them. We don't know if it's the majority of the industry that is involved in this or not. We tracked that, and we couldn't get a clear answer on that.
And Terry, tell us about a man named Timmy Solomon that you follow who really exemplifies what's happening.
I actually didn't personally follow him. That was Lori Beshida and Mindy Schauer, who got the most amazing and disturbing and incredibly profound, you know, photographs of the agony of this that I've ever seen. But, you know, Timmy was, you know, scrounging up cans behind a supermarket in San Clemente to get enough money to get high one more time before he went to rehab. Because he just, you know, wanted one last gasp. And, you know, we followed him for 3 months, and, you know, he was in and out and relapsing and in again and out again. And, you know, his, you know, poor mother is watching this and trying to help, but it's really hard. I think Andre can speak a little bit more to Timmy.
Yeah, he was he exemplifies the problem. He was recruited here to Southern California, I want to say 4 years ago from Boston. He's a little older than some of the people who've been brought out here. He's 28. He's not technically on an Obamacare plan anymore, but his parents do had recently purchased some insurance for him. He claims he's been into rehab roughly 40 times. Now, that seemed a little far-fetched when I first heard it. I'm not sure if I believe that exact number, but the notion of him living essentially in rehab, sober living, and getting to sort of cycle through this. He also lives on the streets when he's not involved in either of these places. You know, it seems to be the pattern for him. Now, also, to be clear, he's currently, at least last we heard, you know, 50 or 60 days sober. So, you know, I don't want to paint this guy as being a, you know, and obviously everybody has hope, and he may in fact recover. But his journey right now, the reason we focused on a person was because we wanted to, you know, humanize the story, but also he was very indicative of what is going on.
So what happens when someone like Timmy goes into one of these rehab centers, a rehab center that is not an ethical one?
Right. There are, you know, some places are aimed at one of the complaints we heard from people who run ethical rehab centers, and most of the people who are quoted in the story who are complaining about this actually are people who try to do a good job. They point out that there's something they complain about, the six-bed policy, right? They say that to run and make a lot of money or make a decent amount of money running a rehab center with six beds and doing a good job medically is difficult, that the margins are pretty low. What happens in the kind of centers you're talking about is often there's not a lot of licensing that's required to get to run a rehab center. In fact, what we found was that rehab management is actually taught in prison. If you take prison school or you go to school in prison, you can get a certificate in this. And there are people who have, you know, long, naturally drug-related crimes wind up running these things. So anyway.
Well, at least they know what they're talking about.
Yeah, and there's a little of that. And then there, so the notion is that there are places where sobriety is the goal. There are places where sobriety is not necessarily the goal.
So, Terry, then what happens? So they spend some time in these places. They're supposed to be clean, right, when they're in these rehab centers?
They're supposed to be clean. And, you know, there was some very, you know, sort of disturbing stuff from some families in Costa Mesa, which has got one of the highest concentrations of rehabs and sober living homes in the whole country. You know, people bring in drugs. You know, the sober living homes are usually run by a house manager who is only maybe, you know, a few months sober, you know, themselves. So, these folks are all, you know, living together and they're, you know, supposed to be making their first steps back into the world, right? Back into a, you know, a sober situation. But somebody will, you know, get their hands on some drugs and bring them in. And, you know, we talk to people whose, you know, children died in sober living homes when somebody brought in, you know, heroin and meth and they, you know, they just OD'd. And we looked at a lot of police reports from, you know, San Juan Capistrano. The cities won't track, you know, there's these homes are not licensed. There's no, you know, reason to treat them any differently than any other family, at least according to the law. So the cities won't track, you know, they won't, if you say, I would like all calls to the sober living homes, they laugh at you and say, sorry, we don't have those. If we kept that, we would be accused of discrimination. We would be sued, which is a whole other thing that happens a lot and costs cities a lot of money. But the I'm sort of rambling here. I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. So then once these patients fail, then they're kicked out?
Yeah, one of the things we, you know, again, it's tricky to get data on this, but a lot of people who track homelessness have noticed that homelessness has been on the increase over the last 5 or 6 years, which kind of contradicts the way the economy's worked, right? We've had a recovery since 07, but we seem to have a bigger number of homeless folks out there. Nobody can say it's a one-for-one thing, but a lot of the people who wind up outside of the rehab industry or outside of rehab get what they call curbed. There's a term for it in the industry, and they get booted, and they wind up homeless. So that's when you see, you know, the big increases in homeless encampments. Again, we're not saying this is a one-to-one thing. We don't know. Nobody knows for sure. But it is it's clearly a factor.
And then they start the whole cycle all over again?
Yeah.
Maybe?
Yep.
Yeah. That's what happened with Timmy. I mean, he got his hands on some drugs while he was in the sober living home, and he got kicked out of the sober living home and, you know, then went back to a detox and then, you know, back to another sober living home. So, you know, it's a very circular system. And, you know, what it suggests is that the way we're approaching the problem of treatment and recovery is not working. And there's a lot of research on, you know, why that is and what should be done. It's, you know, it's a more long-term and expensive proposition to look at, you know, taking care of someone or treating someone for, you know, 5 years than it is to say, oh, we're paying for 30 days, you know, in a treatment center. And so that's a problem that we as a society are going to really have to grapple with if we want to get our arms around this opioid addiction.
And where is the state on this in terms of regulating these homes? And
the state is, it's a work in progress. Terry, why don't you talk about this, because I think you're working on a follow-up story about that.
Yeah. The state of California, as you know, some of the, you know, the biggest operators in, you know, addiction recovery centers say, is in the dark ages when it comes to regulating these things. You know, anybody, there's virtually no criminal history you can have that will prevent you from opening one of these, and, you know, as evidenced by it being taught in prison. You don't need to be a medical doctor. You don't even need to have any formal training. You can say, you know, I want to be an addiction counselor because I want to help people, and I'm going to get my training. I will start working on it now. And you can open a facility and treat people who are, you know, in these life or death situations with, you know, very limited education and formal, you know, training in how to deal with all this. And, you know, again, the bigger operators are saying, you know, you guys are, you've got to get on your legislature. You guys have got to change the rules and you know, professionalize this industry.
And they are receiving public money for this.
You know, most of the money is coming through insurance. Now, there are, when insurance companies and rehab centers go to court and they fight about it, and there's not a payment made, the rehab centers often can write that number off. The estimate for this year is like $300 million, something like that. It would be in write-offs to rehab centers that didn't get insurance payments that were contested. That said, and there are public monies that are spent
Medicaid,
in a lot of different
Medicaid
ways.
Medicaid is big in this, yeah.
Yeah. And also, there's many ancillary costs. The folks who come here, everything from ambulance services to police services to homeless services, all of that adds up too.
And so from your reporting, you found that here in Southern California, it has a much bigger problem with this than either any other part of the state or any other part of the country?
Only place that comes close is Florida. The two places are kind of considered the twin epicenters, if you will, of this. To be honest, I can't speak to Florida why that is particularly. I know that they have a long history of having, again, the same kind of, you know, the weather and come out and, you know, have, you know, recover in a nice setting. But I don't know what the particulars are as far as why it's big there.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for your incredible series.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks.
I appreciate it.
And I urge everyone to go out there and read it. Really eye-opening. Terry Seforza, investigative reporter at the OC Register. Andre Mouchard, editor at the OC Register. Coming up on the program, the evolution of the Los Angeles hipster, less lumberjack and more hippie. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Handmade ceramics, healing crystals, turmeric, dresses that look like cocoons. Those are just some of the tools of the Silver Lake Shaman. You might know one, or you might even be one. The lifestyle is taking over the East Side. It's all about health, wellness, and spirituality. It's making waves around the globe. Here in the studio to explain it is Jenny Avens, lifestyle correspondent for Quartz. Hello.
Hello.
The Shaman. Did you coin that term?
I did.
You did. And so what are its essential oils, its essential elements?
I think you just named many of them, but it tends to be a lot of clothes that have these very sort of natural-looking handmade finishings, kind of modernist hippie interiors, a lot of natural light, smudge sticks, which are those sage bundles tied up in twine.
That's not a new accessory.
No. And it's funny, I think a lot of these things are not necessarily new, but what's new is the way that we're consuming them, meaning not just the way that we're buying them and eating them and drinking them and wearing them, but also I think Instagram has a huge part in sort of spreading this around the country and the globe, that all of a sudden there's awareness of this, I think, kind of very appealing lifestyle that does look really good on Instagram.
Where is its headquarters, this lifestyle?
I think one of them is, I think there are many, but I think last weekend you probably would have seen a lot of it at the Echo Park Craft Fair.
I have been to that craft fair. I know what you're talking about.
I think in Venice, this does exist on the West Side at General Store in Venice. That's a great place if you needed like a starter kit that you could probably get a lot of what you needed there. It will not be cheap, though.
There's something called moon dust created by moon juice.
Mm-hmm.
What is that?
I couldn't be sure exactly of the ingredients, but it's like there's moon dust, there's sex dust, there's spirit dust, and they contain, I think, a variety of dehydrated like mushroom protein and cacao and other sort of powdered potions that you can sprinkle onto your smoothies or matcha lattes.
Here is the creator of Moon Dust, which she's the creator of Moon Juice, and her name is Amanda Chantal Bacon. Let me get that correct. Amanda Chantal Bacon. And here's a clip of her talking about how she found her calling.
There was an Ayurvedic doctor visiting from India, and he heard me coughing and through divine intervention comes over and looks in the whites of my eyes, looks at my tongue. He decided within moments that it was sugar, wheat, and dairy. Well, I've gone a long way. Like 30 years later, I'm milking Brazil nuts and making tiny raw donuts.
Okay, it's easy to parody. Yeah. So, but what is the aesthetic? What is the appeal of this aesthetic and this lifestyle?
I mean, I think in some ways it's the idea that, you know, we could kind of cleanse ourselves of this kind of, I don't know, artisanal whiskey hangover from...
It has to be artisanal, the whiskey.
Yeah. that we've had like 10 or 15 years of plaid shirts and taxidermied animals and this and that kind of hyper-masculine aesthetic that, you know, I think we sort of in Brooklyn call like the Brooklyn lumberjack look, and that there is something really appealing about natural light and I mean, I think avocado toast is delicious.
So that's part of it, the avocado toast?
I think so.
It seems like it's more of a feminine aesthetic, is what you're saying.
I do think it is. I think it is more of a feminine aesthetic. There's sort of an ease to it that I think women, I don't know, certainly women, in my opinion, look better in caftans and these sorts of
things.
You can
hide a lot of issues.
I am caftan ready this summer.
Well, so how has this seeped into the larger pop culture?
I think we see it. We see it on menus. Like I was saying, I think we see it a lot on Instagram. Certainly in New York, you see this aesthetic in a lot of stores too, where previously there might have been these sort of Portlandia-ish, you know, taxidermied animals or birds on everything, that now it's more dream catchers and, you know, lots of crystals and sort of desert-scented candles. And yeah, I think that's where we see it, especially in interiors.
Yeah. So could it be described as a Big Sur, Joshua Tree, Ace Hotel type of aesthetic?
Totally.
Yeah. So it would seem that California, Southern California, that has permeated. It's gone eastward rather than the Brooklyn coming westward.
Yes, I think that's true.
Okay. So as I said, it's easy to parody. Mm-hmm. There have been parodies out there. Does that mean it's on the way out?
I don't think so. I think it's going to be around for a while. I mean, I sort of hope it's going to be around for a while. I have to be honest, I really like it.
Well, what is it that you like about it?
I like a lot of the products. I like the sort of ease of it. I think, you know, some of this hippy dippy stuff really does appeal to me at heart, but I think you know, that Amanda Chantal Bacon is probably the extreme version of it, but that there are some valuable ideas in this. Especially, I talked to Beatrice Valenzuela from the Echo Park Craft Fair, and she was sort of talking about how they started, and that it really was this community-based thing that was about connecting with your neighbors and knowing where your clothes come from and sort of feeling like you didn't want to be part of this fast fashion machine. And I think there's real value in that. I think that fast fashion machine is going to start knocking off their styles pretty quickly if they haven't already. But I think that
some it's also not cheap, this lifestyle.
Well, yeah. And that's another piece of it. And that's true. It is that you could buy maybe one or two of these products in a summer instead of buying, you know, 15 sundresses and 3 bikinis and God knows how many sandals from, you know, Zara and H&M.
All in earth tones.
All in earth tones.
Okay. Yeah. Jenny Avens, Quartz's lifestyle correspondent. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Christian Bordahl is here now with listener feedback. Hi.
Yes, and they do have some thoughts about the phenomenon of the Silver Lake Shaman. As you might imagine, we got a few snarky comments. Alex Lancaster wrote, "A moon juice customer and his money are soon parted." Daniel Lucas Reha said, "Very loud, nauseated groan." John G. Hill writes, "The only thing that really works is exercise. Clears the mind, too." But Dan Fuller writes, "You can't label me, man." And Joy Wolf says, "We're cool again." I guess meaning hippies. And Douglas Arthur Meyer says, "I prefer the term yippie, or young urban hippie, as coined by the late, great Timothy Leary." So there you go, man. A little bit of both sides.
All right. Thank you, Christian Bordahl.
Absolutely.
And thank you for listening. Anyone who wants to call themselves anything at all, you're welcome to weigh in on Twitter @KCRW Press Play. I'm Madeline Brown. I'll see you tomorrow.